I don't think they ever did. No, never. Just that he was someone bad. Paper rustled. You will agree that the world is a better place without him. The word world is capitalized. I noticed that, and a couple of other grammar things. So he's not too literate. You never know, Mr. Kinney, Mr. Daly. He might be a female and more literate than you or me, faking it. Though you're right, on the surface it appears to have been written by a person with little education, probably male. Of course, that generates the question of how and why some semi-literate person could and would set up and execute this complex stunt. Her use of the word stunt was interesting. Wait, do you still think that I might have done this stunt myself? Nothing is off the table, Mr. Daly. My personal opinion is that you didn't do it. People who haven't seen the recording of your interview, who don't know anything about you, might think otherwise. But it's ridiculous. Why would I go to all that trouble just to get into more trouble? You're an educated man and a writer. You know that people do things for odd reasons or no reason. That you or someone else would set this up is odd, but odd things happen. That was almost exactly what Blackstone had said. Maybe it's a mantra you have to learn for Homeland Security. And I suppose my fingerprints are all over the note. In fact, no. That piece of paper has been folded and unfolded and crumpled up, but as far as we can tell, no one has ever touched it without gloves. You do admit to reading it? Shit. I loved where this was going. Of course. I told Blackstone, why would you put on gloves to read a note? Why would an innocent person avoid leaving fingerprints on anything? I had to admit that was a pretty good question. I guess I was in a suspicious frame of mind, cautious frame of mind. I started to take the rifle out of the box, but then I thought, hell, I'm taking this straight to the cops. I don't want to mess up any prints that might be on it. Long pause. But in the event, you actually didn't take it to the police. No, like I said, that's when the woman called. I heard her exhale in exasperation. I'm trying to make a list here. First, your doorbell rang late at night. Morning, about 4 in the morning. What were you doing up at that hour? I wasn't up. The phone woke me up. Calm down, Mr. Daly. I'm trying to decipher the notes from your conversation with Mr. Blackstone. You went to the door and there was no one there. I heard a car leaving, peeled out, before I opened the door. There was no sign of them when you opened the door? Nothing but the box. I heard tires squealing while I was getting dressed. What did you think it was, 4 in the morning? I don't know. Kids, I guess. Why did you go to the door when the phone rang? Not the phone, the doorbell. Okay. Kids rang the doorbell and left behind an expensive sniper rifle. A really bad feeling was growing in my head. Could I open my mouth without screaming? It would feel so good to throw the phone into the traffic. Are you there, Mr. Daly? What would it sound like on her end when a car ran over it? Would it be loud enough to be worth the cost? Mr. Daly. I took a deep breath. Add this to your list. I've had enough abuse for the day. My shoulders and wrists hurt from being manhandled by jackbooted fucking stormtroopers. On your list, I want you to write down the time of day. Call me exactly 24 hours from now, and I'll answer. If the phone rings before that, I will throw it in the fucking Mississippi. I snapped it shut with a sound like a rifle shot. An elderly couple sitting down at the next table smiled and applauded softly. "Whoever they are," the old lady said. "Fuck them." I gave her a V sign, my grandfather's generation. God bless the 60s. The phone rang again. I opened it. Didn't you hear what I said? It was a familiar woman's voice, but not Sarah Underwood's. It was the mystery woman who first talked to me in Iowa City and threatened me with the story about the boy who died of myelofibrosis.
Jack, we know where you are now. Are you ready to talk?
I threw the phone into the street and got up to rush to Corn Dog's. Bikes in a Box. 1. Something must have shown on my face when I returned to the restaurant. Mario was by the grill chopping onions, and he came over with the big chef's knife in his hand. "Something wrong?" he said. "Hate to leave you in the lurch, man. We have to get out of here." Kit untied her apron wordlessly and started folding it.
"You have to."
I nodded.
"Shit happens," he said, setting the knife down.
He went around the counter and punched the cash register hard and scooped out 2 C-notes and a 50 from the till.
"We couldn't, Mario," Kit said.
He put the money on the counter and looked at me.
"I never seen you guys."
He turned to go back to his onions.
"Good luck, anyhow. In bocca al lupo."
He'd taught us that phrase, like break a leg. We had Plan A mapped out completely. Every morning before we left for work, we packed everything we owned into 2 knapsacks, so we could go into the apartment and out in seconds. There was a bike shop on the way. The 2 we'd picked out, a couple of sturdy touring treks, had been sold, but 2 new ones had just come in. He'd unboxed them this morning and almost had them together. It seemed like a good omen, starting out fresh, so we bought them and 2 sets of rear baskets. While the kid was bolting the baskets on, we went back to the apartment and picked up the knapsacks and left the key on the dresser. As an afterthought, Kit left a note saying we'd been called north and expected to be back before the 1st, but if we weren't, go ahead and rent the room. We left our Jazzy Pass RTA cards with the note. We had 2 detailed route maps that took us from New Orleans to Miami on back roads, and then down A1A to Key West. We would travel apart, Kit leaving an hour before me, the routes slightly different wherever possible. They'd be looking for a couple our age traveling together. Not trusting cell phones, we'd bought a pair of kids' walkie-talkies from the phone shop. I could call her every hour on the hour and let it buzz once. If she didn't buzz back soon, it meant she was in trouble. Or we'd been betrayed by cheap phone shop technology. Not impossible. We split our cash down the middle, $4,320 each. Decided to go ahead and use her credit cards for the bikes, since the feds knew where we were anyhow. All my cards were flat. I downloaded a list of bicycle-friendly hotels for the states we'd be going through. We chose one just outside of town, about 20 miles away for the 1st night, and I sent Kit on ahead. Locked my bike up outside the Black Cat, our favorite tavern, and had one last imported beer before taking off into the land of Country General Stores and Bud Light. We'd made up our routes from a library copy of the Southern Tier Trail, Southern Tier Tourist Maps, which kept you away from highways and cities and decent beer. It's very close to what my hero in the novel was doing, in reverse, but the only reference to that in the whole world was buried in Duquest's files. Maybe my agents. Under anybody's radar. Kit was carrying the fake Glock, the pellet gun with the orange nose spray-painted black, figuring that if one of us was going to need it on these deserted country roads, it would be her. My thinking had gone a little beyond that, though. The one morning drunk at the bar got up and left. I took a G-note out of my pocket and smoothed it onto the bar.
Jimmy, I said to the bartender,
maybe you can help me with a little problem. 2 hours later, I was down in Bayou Country, headed east on Route 90, a bright red accessory bag on a quick-release clip in the center of my handlebars. It held my wallet, maps, some nuts, and a candy bar, and a snub-nosed Taurus 38 Special, the favorite little pistol of TV detective actors. Actual criminals probably favor something with more punch, but a new 357 Magnum would have cost nearly 1,000 more. I didn't want anything bigger anyhow. When I unsnap the bag and carry it into a convenience store, I don't want the clerk to gauge its weight and reach for his own gun. I'd bought it from a black guy who had conspicuous tracks on his left forearm and hadn't bathed in a while, but his hands were steady and his eyes clear, so I assumed he was a cop or worked for them, which didn't bother me too much. If somebody tried to bust me, I would have Sarah Underwood rain some Homeland Security shit on them, though she might just ask them to lock me up and throw away the key. There was enough truck traffic to keep me from being bored, and the road was pretty rough. The bikes were set up for endurance rather than speed, medium-fat tires with Kevlar inserts. Fewer miles per day, but no flats. And we could go off-road if necessary. There were no good scenarios that involved that, though. If someone was after us with a car, we were just caught. I wasn't going to hit the dirt and lay down a field of fire, not with 5 rounds of 38 special ammo indifferently aimed. 25 rounds if I had time to reload a few times, which didn't seem likely. I guess the gun was more of a psychological crutch than actual protection, as my M2010 had been in the desert most of the time. If you live with a weapon 24/7, it becomes like another limb, and any time it's out of sight, you start to panic. So when is a crutch not a crutch? When you could walk better without it? I'd gone unarmed for most of 8 years, but the feeling of symbiosis, of dependence, came back immediately. It made me feel more calm, in control, even though my rational brain knew that was nonsense. If any of our enemies produced a weapon, it would trump the hell out of a Dick Tracy snub-nosed 38 not-so-special revolver. But it was better than nothing. Nothing would be total helplessness, being a target rather than a foe. And even though Sarah Underwood probably already had a memo on her desk with the serial number and exact provenance of my 38, whoever was after us probably didn't know yet. That might buy us a second or two in a few of the less likely futures that we faced. Two. We had figured that it would be safe enough if we came together each night. Two people on bicycles might be conspicuous at a mom-and-pop motel, but two carless bikers at two separate motels would be even more conspicuous, and we felt safer together. She called me on the walkie-talkie and said there was a vacancy at the place we'd tentatively chosen, the Southern Comfort Motel, a half mile up the road.